Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we talk about the book Family of Spies. We talk to Scott Simpson, president of America's Credit Union. We talk about the books The Culting of America and End Time Masters, as well as the book You Can't Catch Us, Lady Bird Johnson's trailblazing 1964 campaign train and the women who rode with her.
They're a dynamic duo here to discuss the latest work by one, Mark Schiaponi, with us. Glad that you are here, Mark. Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Christine Kuhn, appreciate you as well.
Thank you for having us.
Different last names, but obviously on a trek together. Family of Spies, a World War II story of Nazi espionage, betrayal, and the secret behind Pearl Harbor. I know you, former journalist Christine, the pen behind the work, but Mark, your role being very instrumental in the research of Families of Spies as well. Take me back to this two story, Christine.
Yeah, so we can start back in 1987 when I first met my aunt for the first time. My dad never spoke about her much growing up. And when he asked me if I wanted to meet her, I was like so excited. And I asked Mark, we were dating at the time, to go to Charleston. And we went in and met her. She was a sweet little old lady. And about halfway through the conversation, I noticed a wedding picture. And I asked her, are those my grandparents? And she nods her head. And so I, start pinging her with questions to tell me about them. My dad never speaks about them. And she pulled up her finger in a thick German accent and said, you have a good life. Don't ruin it with the past. Don't ask me any more questions about your grandparents, the past, or Pearl Harbor. So that it kind of threw me off. I wasn't quite sure what she was talking about, but I didn't ask her any more questions. Tumble forward, 1994, Mark and I are married now with two young kids, and I get a letter from a screenwriter, and it's asking all these questions about my grandfather, his involvement with the Nazi party, and spying for the Japanese, and I was totally confused, and it kind of started that 30-year journey to try and find the hidden truth about my family.
Yes, Mark, add to that as a spouse.
Well, when we first started this research, it was we had found out that Christie's grandfather was the only person ever tried and convicted for the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So we started doing the research on that. So we kept finding all these books. We went to Borders Books on date night one night, and we kept pulling books from the shelves, and they told these fantastical stories about her grandfather and her Aunt Ruth leading the attack on Pearl Harbor from the dormer window in the attic of the house overlooking Pearl Harbor and telling the Japanese what to bomb and where to go. And it was just, jaw-dropping to think that could be true.
Let's get more into the family of spies that you write, reading like a thriller, but it's your real life, Christine. As you wrote the book, were there moments when you had to pause, not because of the classification, but because of the emotional weight? And did you share this with any family members?
Yeah, the research stopped and started over the 30 years multiple times. And in 2020, when we finally decided, okay, let's write the book, right? Mm-hmm. Let's put it out there. And, there was one really incident. It was when I had finally connected with my German family, and it was Leopold's grandson. And he sent me pictures. And when I opened it up, one of them was a wedding picture. And he's dressed in full Nazi regale, the swastika on his shoulder. And I was just stunned. And I remember looking at that picture and, I knew they were Nazis. I'd done this research for years, but seeing it in black and white, and it wasn't just words on a page, I looked at Mark and said, I don't want to dig any deeper. It was just too hard. So it was a really difficult journey the entire time, actually.
Yes, both of you, I know your careers in journalism. Mark, espionage, I think, is often glamorized in pop culture. How does the work of Christine, and of course you're along on the journey, challenge the myths we have about spy life?
From what we found, the FBI had 800 pages of research, documents on the family, memos to President Roosevelt and from J. Edgar Hoover, and each one of them had tiny little details. It was, what we found is espionage is really a long game, and it's not some spine tingling, breaking through a wave of lasers trying to break into a safe. It's really a lot of observation and putting the dots together. So, they paid her grandfather, I think, the sum of $1.5 million, but it was over 5 years. So he was just getting little bits of information, ship movements here and there, to put it all together.
Christine, your book subtitled A World War II Story of Nazi Espionage, Betrayal, and the Secret History Behind Pearl Harbor. Put the spotlight a bit on the betrayal aspect here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was hard. They came to the United States and to act like they came as sleeper spies to kind of live in the community. So they made friends. They, you know, the kids went to the local Lutheran church and to the school there. And so they built this network in Hawaii. And in the end, they were actually spying to help the Japanese bomb Hawaii. I think that's what my father had the hardest problem with, you know, that here he was, he didn't know anything about what his sister and parents were doing. And he loved being in America. He loved his friends. He was living a very idyllic childhood in paradise, right? And so when everything came to be and, you know, December 7th, we all know what happened. And then my dad realized what his parents had been doing for the past 6 years. I think it was really hard for him. And I'm not sure he ever really got 100% over what his parents and his sister had done.
And Mark, what would you hope readers take away from those who grew up in families defined by secrecy, silence, and more?
Well, I think everybody's got these secrets, that are buried back in their family somewhere. And from what Chrissy has had to go through, you know, I'm an arm's length from it. This is actually her family. For instance, when she discovered, we found her Aunt Ruth in this book, the World's 30 Greatest Women Spies. And she was right there next to Mata Hari from all the spying that she had done in Hawaii. And so when we tried to reconcile that picture of her back in 1987, this sweet little old lady serving us tea, and then put it against this sort of femme fatale super spy, apparently, it was hard to reconcile. So I think the takeaway for myself and for Chrissy is that, you know, your family, there's things back in your family that you're going to have to deal with, but it doesn't necessarily reflect on you. You can turn the page.
Christine, how do we find out more information about your work, Family of Spies, please?
Well, I am on Instagram, cks.collective. So that is, I do a lot of posting about where I'm speaking. You can also get the book at any local retailer, Amazon, and can learn about the book and the family history. And hopefully readers will feel challenged to do some research of their own.
Christine Kuehn. Kuehn. Your book is all about Family of Spies. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate you as well. Take care, both of you. For many consumers, access to credit, could it be a bridge to a more stable future? For decades, credit unions have helped families plan and navigate financial challenges. So let's talk about the credit union, how the consumers are accessing credit, managing everyday expenses, and more. Scott Simpson, President and CEO, America's Credit Unions. Can't get any bigger than that. Good morning to you, Scott.
Good morning, Shelley. Good to be with you.
Appreciate you. How do you define today's credit union?
Credit union is a member-owned, not-for-profit cooperative, which means that there's the gap between the shareholder and the customer is zero. It's the same person. Different than a bank. A bank does, excuse me, the bank's responsibility is to extract as much as it can for the shareholder, which is a completely different individual than the customer. And so that's the difference. That's what we... That's how we present ourselves to the marketplace. And at the end of the day, the American consumer that is a credit union member ends up with, you know, better fees on the products and services they use at their financial institution. They get better interest on their deposits and lower interest rates on their loans.
Let me ask some specific questions, if I may, with your leadership. With the cost of living still a major concern for many, how are credit unions helping families manage, well, basic everyday expenses and basically maintaining financial stability, Scott?
Again, it's creating opportunity because of the business model of a not-for-profit, member-owned cooperative. It allows credit unions to lend differently. It allows us to make decisions that banks can't or won't make. And so there's just greater opportunity at a credit union. And it allows people to keep more of their money. And when they keep more money, our members can put shoes on their kids. They can put sandwiches in the lunch pail, all of those things to help improve the lives of everyday Americans.
Thanks for the reminders of the basics. Let's talk cybersecurity, a top consumer concern. How do credit unions offer, I trust, safeguards to members to keep their financial data and life savings protected here?
That's an increasingly important question, Shelley. Credit unions, like everybody in financial services, are not immune from the industrialization of bad actors out there. We're investing, along with our technology partners, millions of dollars to fortress our membership and their data. And I think you use history to predict the future, and the history of financial institutions as those that are safeguarding, and knock on wood, obviously, but we have a very good track record, and we do a very good job of the technology side of investing in the neural networks, in AI, using it to learn about the behavior of not only our consumers but the bad actors. And so I have great confidence in our capacity to engage in that environment based on our track record. I do think one of the most important investments that we can make is in our relationship with our credit union members to begin with. You and I are the most important fortress against these bad actors, the scammers that would prey on our emotions and urgency. And so that's my invitation today, is to have everyone just slow down. If you get a text message or an email or a phone call that feels off, hang up the phone. Pull out your credit card, flip it over, and call the number on the back of that card and talk to an individual. Walk into the branch of your credit union and ask them if it's legit. If you'll just slow down on those, even if it feels urgent, if it feels like it's coming from government or some law enforcement agency, slow down. Go in and have that conversation with your financial institution, and that's the most effective way to push back against these threats.
America's Credit Union's President and CEO, Scott Simpson, on the line. Are there current legislative threats that could affect how credit unions serve their members?
Yeah, there are. They're a little counterintuitive, but just recently there's been a couple of pieces of legislation in the credit card space. One was a federal price fix that would essentially have said you can only charge 10% on credit card interest rates. And as a consumer, you think that's fantastic. I would love, top rate cap, but here's the challenge. Part of our responsibility as a financial institution is not just to extend credit, but is to protect, to safeguard the life savings of all of our members. And that transaction of taking the life savings of our members and extending that at credit is called risk. And we have to be able to charge for that risk in order to extend the risk. And we estimate, with that federal price fix, bringing the pricing down to that point, that would just require financial institutions of every stripe, banks and credit unions, to potentially withdraw access to credit unions by maybe 80% of credit card holders. And that's just devastating. It's the distortive effect of using the heavy hand of government in the free market system. And I think folks are starting to appreciate that in the lawmaking space, but we just need to keep the pressure up. And then the other side is another credit card related bill, is to try to force the credit card issuers to ride technology rails that are created by the big box retailers. We just think that's a bad idea. That's not going to help. We've learned in engaging policy brought forward by the big box retailers that they're not interested in protecting the consumer. What they're interested in is transferring wealth from the payment rail system to their back pockets. And so we're asking consumers to weigh in against that bill as well.
Wonderful. How do we find out more information in general?
I would go to americascreditunions.org. We can help steer you toward weighing in on those, you know, bad pieces of legislation and pushing back against the lawmaking pressure that's there. And then we'd also love to give you the directions and help you find your way to your local credit union. We've got 2/3 of the country that still need to join, so we're very interested in that.
You know, strong in our own backyard as well. Scott Simpson, President, CEO, America's Credit Unions. Take care to you.
Thank you, Shelley.
Daniela Mestinek-Young on the line, co-authoring with Amy Reed. The book is The Culting of America. Subtitle, What Makes a Cult and Why We Love Them. Let's talk to you, Daniela, yourself, a cult survivor, U.S. Army veteran. Thank you for your service. Harvard-trained organizational psychologist. Of course, a couple books under your pen as well. Daniela, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Quite welcome. You're probably in a cult, you just don't know it yet, is a question I begin with. Tell us more about your work.
My work is meant to show that the tactics and techniques that cults use are all around us in America, and all kinds of groups are using them, and our culture is kind of full of this stuff. And I don't think it matters as much if you label something a cult as if you can understand the tactics and the coercion and manipulation that are being used on you.
Yes. Are most of us still picturing the robes, the chanting, the remote compounds, never thinking we'd ever fall for a cult, Daniela?
Absolutely, yes. I think that Americans are relatively unaware that cults can exist in a two-person relationship, in a single family, on the internet, or even just in everyday life, but it's not what the stereotype looks like.
Before we get into your work, The Culting of America, can you remind us of your title as a cult survivor?
Yeah, so I was born into the Children of God, which is the cult that is famous for using religious prostitution and pedophilia. It produced my fellow colleagues like Joaquin and River Phoenix and Rose McGowan. And I grew up all over the world being trafficked by this cult and used as a child performer to make money for the organization. And I left when I was 15 years old and have been learning everything about cults since then.
Yes. How does one leave when they're 15?
You get yourself kicked out. Before I turned 16, at which point I was going to be an adult in a free love cult that didn't use birth control, and I knew that I needed to get away. So I broke a really big rule, which was having a boyfriend outside the cult. And also, my mother was born and raised in this cult and had me at 15. And so she encouraged me to get away as well.
More into your book, The Culting of America. So if I thrive in a boardroom, a group chat, a fitness class, a political rally, a religious group, or a corporate retreat, could that be a cult?
Absolutely.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
In my opinion, we don't have good cults because cults really are groups that are coercing and manipulating you in order to exploit your labor. And I completely understand that people who run groups want that amount of dedication from their members, but the reality is the amount of dedication that cult members give to a cult is absolutely unhealthy for the individual, and it's always going to harm the individual.
You have a chapter dedicated to the us versus them mentality. We are the best, down with all the rest. What's this about?
It is about the way that cults teach you that number one rule of a cult is we are the ones. In fact, choosing a name with the is very common. We are the right ones and everyone else is wrong. So we start this chapter looking at sororities and fraternities to bring people into that mindset. But we really get into America and our history going all the way back to the Puritans and our history with cults, but also with this us versus them sort of American exceptionalism that we have.
The Culting of America, What Makes a Cult and Why We Love Them, Daniela Mestinek-Young. All right, let's get more into, I guess, why we love them, and you even dedicate another chapter to trying to get out of them, such as I need to leave my my group, but my membership is on the riff. Tell me more.
Yes, ma'am. You know, I think we love cults in part because in America, our individualism has kind of destroyed other natural forms of community. Capitalism has destroyed natural forms of community. And so many of us are looking for this evolutionary thing that humans desire, which is to live in a village and be surrounded by people that you know that love you and you can count on. And that is what cults really trade on. What happens when it's time to leave, you know, this chapter on exit costs, we call it cost what to quit my membership, is you're always free to leave a cult, but you will lose absolutely everything. So you have paid entrance costs to get into this group, which often includes cutting very important people out of your life. And when you leave, you're going to lose everything, not just money, not just physical things, but your group, your connection, and even sometimes your certainty that you are doing life the right way.
You say in your acknowledgement that the book is the result of a lifetime of trying to understand the impossible, how groups change people, how people try to change the world through groups. I guess the final question is, what's the take-home message? I don't want to leave my boards because, you know, we're helping others. But how do I avoid, you know, this cultish, perhaps, negativity?
Yeah, so this is why, as an organizational psychologist, I realized I kind of didn't care about the groups. I cared about the individual. And so the takeaway from this whole book is to really show you these are the tactics that are being used. And if you can spot an individual tactic, why is this man who's your boss obsessed with all of the women wearing pantyhose to work, for example, right? Well, if you've read the book and you know that cults are always trying to control your underwear, you have the language to sort of think about this, understand why you feel that it might be concerning, and then either set boundaries or get yourself out of there. Because the reality is, any time in the space of personal transformation, any organization that you give a lot of your time and attention to, predators are going to show up. And so we're never going to get rid of predators. We're never going to get rid of all the bad groups. I just want to help people stop falling for the same tactics over and over again. And so that's kind of the so what of this book, is it will help you diagnose the groups that you're in. And ultimately, you won't have to give up being involved in all of these groups. You'll just be able to better navigate it without harm to yourself or others.
Thank you for doing the behind-the-scenes work on this, The Culting of America. Daniela, how do we find out more information?
So I can be found on almost all the social media channels. My username is Knitting Cult Lady, and my website is www.knittingcultlady.com. And I knit and talk about bad guys, and it's a wild time to be an expert on the bad guy. So,
and you're saying you knit, K-N-I-T?
Yes.
Well, that's a whole other conversation, but that's a good thing.
Yep. I'm just always knitting, and it helps people listen to what I'm saying on these really heavy topics, and it's pretty fun.
Good. Having fun while you do good work, in addition to, again, sharing The Culting of America. All right, Daniela, please take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The work by my next guest, entitled Time Masters, 11 Secrets to Greater Productivity and Life Fulfillment. How timely can this be as we all have our New Year resolutions and more? I bring you on coach, speaker, author, Dr. Jan Yeager, to give us these tools and more. Good morning to you, Dr. Yeager.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you very much. Anything with the word productivity and life fulfillment catches my eye, and probably many of others. And you Of course, no stranger to award-winning books over 63. Lots of translations, lots of research you've done, and, of course, a mom, wife, and all that good stuff as well. Do you make work-life balance a priority in your own life?
Absolutely. I was raised by two loving workaholics, a dentist and a teacher, and it taught me what not to do when I had my own family.
Thanks. We could spend all day talking about that with a similar background. Here we go. Let's talk about the secrets. Talk to me about your premise in Time Masters.
Sure. Well, the important thing is that Time Masters isn't really just a book. It's a blueprint for a fulfilling life. And that's why some of the secrets, seeking and individuals or pets, are as important as the targeting secret of prioritizing. So I know that the book transformed me. It was on the heels of my book, How to Finish Everything You Start, which was more project and product related. But Time Masters just really made me think about, you know, what do I want people to say at each stage in their life? What am I getting out of life, both work-wise, relationship-wise?
Yes. You give us a couple of parts. Most people, you say, we don't need more time. We need a better way to use it. Let's talk about your two-part framework. Where do you begin in part one?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, we begin with the obvious, targeting. And that's so important. So many people, they're all over the place today, especially with social media pulling you in all directions. So that's the first secret. The second one is the one I indicated, pets and individuals. Spend time with people, especially positive, supportive ones. I just had a wonderful experience with my younger son's partner. She, for my birthday, got us a two-person event at something called Painting with a Twist. And we went to the local one, and for 2 hours we chatted and painted, and you know, I made the time for it. You know, that's what we have to do. Secret three is M, machines and technology, and I have found AI can be transformative if used correctly, and that's the important part of that secret, how to correctly use it, not to replace our writing or our thinking, but to facilitate it. And then the last secret in part one is evaluate and innovate. I know this sounds petty, but making sure I take my vitamins is always a challenge. And I found a pill sorter that was large enough to put my three different vitamins into for all the 7 days. And in the last 3 days, I suddenly was able to take my vitamins without it being stressful. So some of our innovations can be as simple as that, or they can be a little bit more complex. But evaluate what's working, what isn't working, and that's part one.
And we talk about part two with you, Dr. Jan Yeager. Again, the book is Time Masters, 11 Secrets to Greater Productivity and Life Fulfillment. She's sharing her secrets. Part two is under Masters. You take us deeper here.
Sure. Well, secret five, the M in Masters is for maximize. And that's a really important concept because so often our culture is on to the next. Well, what can you do with what you already have to make the most of it? And I'm not just talking about projects. I'm also talking about relationships. You know, how can you celebrate your friends? I even have a book, Celebrating Friends and Friendship. I have a new book coming out next month on happy romantic relationships. How can you take your romance, as wonderful as it is, and make it even better? Secret six, arrange your time. I interviewed many people, scores of people, as well as having over 100 surveys completed, and arranging time for those who define themselves as time masters was part of the concept of time blocking. And that is an innovative way that those who are having challenges with their time can get more done, but also have that life fulfillment we're talking about. Stillness, secret seven, pace yourself, create your inner calm. Secret eight, to-do and done lists. I interviewed the list maker guru, Paula Rizzo, who's a TV producer. And she and I are both great advocates of to-do lists. And it's not just a shopping list. It's also, when you think about the bucket list, that it's interesting. I did research on lists, of course. And my own son is doing a book called The To-Do Book, which is coming out next or later in this year. But what I found was that in researching the history of the bucket list movie, which so many people have heard of, and if you haven't seen it, it's really quite powerful. But that was his number one on his own bucket list, was to get a movie made. So nice. It's kind of fun that he actually pulled that off. Number nine in our secrets, endings open up new beginnings. And that's a reframing of my whole book, How to Finish Everything You Start, which became a number one bestseller in India, beating out Harry Potter and Stephen Covey's book for 6 months. Yep. Do we have time to talk about secret number 10?
Yes, I have a minute and a half. Take the floor, please.
Sure. Secret number 10, routines. Now, it's interesting because anyone who has had or has children knows that routines are important for little kids especially. But they're also important for we adults. Right in my own appointment book, I'm not going to tell you what day it is, but I have a heart and I have my pink highlighter around it. And in that heart, it says date night. So your routine could be, you know, updating your email list or making phone calls. So routines are powerful. They're not something to be dreaded. Secret number 11, seek, travel. It could just be traveling to another town or another city in your own state, or it could be international travel. And then the last chapter just expands on all those secrets with more thoughts. So the feedback to Time Masters has been so gratifying and exciting. And, you know, I wake up, I'm informally a member of the Robin Sharma, the 5 a.m. club. Ooh. But this morning I actually got up at 4.
Okay.
Sometimes I sleep in till 6 or 7, but I'm excited about every day, and that's what I share with people through my own insights. Also, some of the great time masters I interviewed or heard from, including David Allen, getting things done.
Great. Jan, need to let you go, Dr. Yeager, with our time crunch. Time Masters, how do we find out more information about you?
Sure, drjanyeager.com. My website, you'll even have a link to purchase the book or find out more about it. And I look forward to hearing from people. Fill out the contact or mailing list forms. And I wish everyone who's listening a wonderful, fulfilling day and life.
Thank you. Time Masters by you, Dr. Jan Yeager, Yeager. Take care. Do you remember Lady Bird Johnson's daring 1964 whistle stop campaign? Let's talk to my next guest, because she remembers, and she wrote about it, her research well written. You can't catch us, Lady Bird Johnson's trailblazing 1964 campaign train and the women who rode with her. Looking forward to this conversation. Good morning to you, Shannon McKenna Schmidt. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on to talk about the extraordinary Lady Bird Johnson.
Yes, keeping history alive, we must. Why your interest?
This book actually grew out of another one that I had previously written about another trailblazing First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. That was called The First Lady of World War II, and it was about Eleanor's trip to the South Pacific during World War II to the front lines for 5 weeks. And after I wrote that book, I got this interest in finding out other momentous journeys that first ladies might have taken. And there was Lady Bird Johnson whistle-stopping down the tracks during the 1964 election.
Yes. Let's get this question out of the way. Lady Bird Johnson, is this her God-given name? Is this her, tell me why the name for those who may be just learning about this?
Lady Bird Johnson's given name was Claudia, and she was given the nickname Lady Bird as a child. And she talks about how she tried to shake that nickname throughout her teen years into adulthood, but it just stuck, and she finally made peace with it. And other people like LBJ would call her Bird, so variations of that nickname.
Thank you. Your work, again, out, You Can't Catch Us. It's described, Shannon, as more than political history, a powerful testament to women-led leadership, resilience, and the pursuit of civility during turbulent times. We'll talk a bit about that, but take us back to 1964.
So this is October 1964, and LBJ is in a race for the presidency against the Republican candidate, Barry Goldwater. The South is seething. They hate LBJ. They're calling him a traitor to the South. He's from the South because 3 months earlier, he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And LBJ's aides are advising him, you don't need the South to win the election. Polls have him leading by wide margins over Goldwater. They're saying, let's just write it off. It's not worth the effort. Well, this isn't going to work for Lady Bird Johnson. She is also from the South. She's proud of her Southern heritage and of what her husband has done for civil rights. And she decides to campaign into the South, and she does it boldly. And I just want to add that this was a time when political candidates' wives were expected to be seen and not heard. And she defied convention by taking a leading role on the campaign trail. She was the first lady to do this. And she did it boldly. She traveled from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans aboard a custom 19-car train called the Lady Bird Special. Oh. They made 47 stops in 4 days. And along the way, she shook up the status quo, and she made national headlines.
Shannon, you also bring us the memory of pioneer women who stood by her. Liz Carpenter, I know, a trailblazing secretary. Of course, First East Wing staff director Dr. Janet Travell, and of course, the first female White House physician. Plus, you can't forget Helen Thomas, Shannon.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that really struck me about this story, this snapshot in time, for the way that it brought together so many trailblazing women on board the Lady Bird Special, including the ones you just mentioned.
Let's talk about a couple of other stories that relate to your themes. How was resilience portrayed in her work?
There was one, the Lady Bird Special was widely deemed a success by political strategists and the press. And there was one reporter's assessment that I really liked. And they said it was a remarkable display of courage, stamina, and old-fashioned political savvy. And I really like that because I think that it really sums up the impact of this trip. And also, I want to add that this was a women-led undertaking. Men were a part of this endeavor. They were an important part. But as Liz Carpenter, who you mentioned, said, women were calling the signals. And so That was remarkable also for the American people to see this at the time. And they really emerged as role models. And Lady Bird faced hostility on the trail, not surprising in some places. And she just handled it all. There are audio recordings of a lot of her speeches. And she really gave a master class in diplomacy and daring.
Speaking with the author of You Can't Catch Us, Lady Bird Johnson's trailblazing 1964 campaign train and the women who rode with her, speaking with author Shannon McKenna Schmidt. Shannon, I trust Lady Bird changed and expanded the role of First Lady?
She did. So Lady Bird was the first First Lady to professionalize the role. As you mentioned, she hired Liz Carpenter as the first East Wing staff director. And Liz was also the first professional news person to be a First Lady's press secretary. So this allowed them to, instead of fighting the media or hiding from the media, they involved the media in their endeavors, which in turn helped get Lady Bird's messages and programs out to the American people. And she was, her role model was Eleanor Roosevelt. So Lady Bird very much wanted to be a conduit between the Oval Office and the American people. And like Eleanor, she was constantly crisscrossing the country to talk to people about the administration's initiatives and also to gather information from people so that the administration could use that to better shape their policies and exact change. And she wanted to be a working First Lady. She said that she considered being First Lady a daily working job.
And yet her husband played a role. The extraordinarily progressive partnership with Lyndon Johnson spanning decades. What was this headline during the 1964 campaign? LBJ, Lady Bird make formidable team?
Yes, I think that might surprise people. They had this extraordinarily progressive partnership, and Lady Bird really became LBJ's most important personal and political advisor. And there's an anecdote that I love. During the 1960 Democratic Convention, when LBJ was accepting the vice presidential nomination on the ticket with John F. Kennedy, there was this veteran male political reporter in the audience, and he said to a colleague something along the lines of, "Lyndon would not be where he is without that woman. She is magnificent." And that's the thing. It was recognized at the time that they had this unique partnership. And he also said in 1960, "She has made my career possible." And I love that he also gave her credit.
Lastly, bring it to today, if you would. Parallels between 1964 and what year are we? 2026, the current political and social climate, including potentially what we're calling the rolling back of women's rights and civil rights.
Absolutely. And when I first began researching this book 3 years ago, it was a bit of a different climate that we have right now. I always intended this to be a story about extraordinary women helping to break down barriers to women's full participation in society. But now I see the title, You Can't Catch Us, as not just an optimistic vision of a better future, but also as an expression of defiance against the forces that would try to drag us backwards.
You continue, please, your acclaimed chronicling of America's First Ladies. Shannon McKenna Schmidt, your latest is out, putting the spotlight on First Lady Lady Bird Johnson. You Can't Catch Us. How do we find out more information?
You Can't Catch Us is officially on sale March 3rd. It should be available at any of your favorite retailers, from online to your local bookstore. And if you'd like more information, you could visit my website at shannonmckennaschmidt.com.
Wonderful. Ever heard of the First Lady Betty Ford?
Yes. Yes, I have. I would love to do more exploring of First Ladies.
Come on to Grand Rapids, and we'll give you the tour at the Gerald R. Ford Museum where Betty lays prominently. Thank you very much to you, Shannon. Take care.
Thank you.